So today, I want to speak about facing the world with metta. First, a bit in the context of working with the difficult category that you've been practicing with in these last days. And then, of course, because half of you may are going into the outer world, practicing there, taking the metta from this container of retreat into the wider world. So working with this difficult category, as you have been doing these last days, it's a place where all of us can encounter so many ideas that we unknowingly have been holding about the way the world should work. We have ideas that somehow the outer world should be satisfying, or that it should be fair, reliable, or predictable, or that there's security to be had in relationship, or that good people should not be treated badly, etc., etc., etc. Now, what does this have to do with metta? Well, often we find ourselves, when we hit a difficult place in the practice, blaming external conditions, events, or people for our suffering, making them the problem, making how unfair it is the problem, or how wrong it is the problem, when in fact people are just who they are. Conditions are what they are. And the suffering on account of that is something we're actually creating. And this is a really hard truth that we tend to resist. But all those assumptions we may unknowingly be holding simply are not true. Because people do bad things. Things that create emotional or even physical pain. And bad, quote unquote, bad, painful things can happen in any relationship to anyone. But there's a huge difference between pain of the inevitable pain of relationship and the suffering on account of that. People and events, can't control them. And they change all the time. That's just nature. And so often when we're challenged in the context of relationship, it's because people change or do things that betray our ideas and our personal sense of who they are or who they should be in relationship to us. They manifest what's called the four worldly winds. In the Anguttara Nikaya, or the eight worldly winds, sorry. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha says, the world revolves around these eight worldly conditions. What eight? Gain and loss, disrepute and fame, blame and praise, pleasure and pain. Everything we experience is the pendulum swinging from one side or the other. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's painful, and it changes. Sometimes we're praised, the next moment there's blame. Anyone on social media knows this one pretty well. Same with fame and disrepute. And gain and loss, these are two things that we experience all the time in our lives. So regardless of whether other people's actions are right or whether they're wrong, if we suffer in a relationship to them, many times, it's because we're attached to some thing or some aspect of this relationship or some aspect of them. We're attached to conditions in the relationships and they change. That's what creates the suffering, the clinging to something that's changing. Not the people themselves, nor their actions. If you think this is too simplistic, examine events in your life and you'll actually see this again and again and again. Passion in a relationship changes to disinterest. Being appreciated changes to being taken for granted. Maybe somebody's usually nice to us, and then one day they're in a bad mood and they're really mean. Being in a relationship where there's mutual care becomes disrupted by an act of harm or betrayal. Or someone we love ups and dies. How dare they? You know? I make a joke of it, but it's not a joke. People die. It's painful. Or they go away. And these shifts can be exquisitely painful and shocking, too, when they happen suddenly. No doubt about it. But painful experiences in relationship with these difficult people, we call them difficult people, but really it's our own difficulty. This is normal. This is an inevitable part of life. And growing up as human beings actually means coming to grips with this. The root of suffering lies not with those events and what those people have done to us, quote unquote, but in our responses to them, the changes in relationships, and the uncontrollability of other people. In this regard, some of us are more resilient naturally than others. Some people crumble at the slightest challenge. But resilience is not set in stone. It's not like you're born with a certain amount of resilience of heart around change, around relationship, and that's it, that's all you get. Of course not. Resilience can be developed. That's the work of metta. That's what you've been doing here in these days. So we start where we are, and we go from there. And one thing to remember if you're judging yourself or judging somebody else about a perceived level of resilience or a perceived lack of it, is that suffering and pain, whether it's physical or mental, is subjective. In terms of physical pain, one person can, you know, respond to a paper cut in the same way as another responds to the cut of a knife. These are two very different injuries. But the level of perceived pain is the same. And with regard to suffering, one person can adjust to terrible events in a life with grace, while another, faced with much, much less, experiences PTSD. Whatever, suffering is suffering is suffering. Our task as human beings is to open to this with compassion. Whatever habits and conditioning we have around the changing nature of life, around these worldly winds, and around pain, either amplify suffering or lead us out of it. And this is, of course, where metta bhavana comes in, or the development of loving kindness comes in. Because life puts us in the middle of this landscape of human change and uncontrollability. And the metta practice offers us a graceful way through that. And in the last couple of days, people have reported such touching experiences of the release of the heart from the kind of pain that gets held for years and years and years. So when strong, difficult states arise around relationship with others, there are no recipes to lead us through that landscape, to lead us to the metta. But Sayadaw mentioned one thing yesterday that's incredibly important, and that's the experience and the inclination to compassion. That this can be immensely supportive of the development of metta in difficulty. Compassion to ourselves and compassion to that other person. Especially if there's nothing that we can find that is in any way good about them. Let's face it, there are people like that in this world. But compassion melts our edges around that kind of person. We see them as a common human being. We might not relate to their way of holding the world or dealing with the world, but we certainly relate to pain. And we certainly relate to what happens when people do things that plant bad karmic seeds. So several people today mentioned this is their doorway into the softening of the heart around immensely difficult people. Understanding that anger arises in us all from causes, from conditioning, from pain, from frustration. And that when we react in anger in unwholesome ways, always, eventually, there will be unpleasant results. You plant an apple seed, you're going to get an apple tree. You plant unwholesome seeds, you're going to get pain as a result. So there's no timetable for that, but it's inevitable. When we touch into this, compassion can naturally arise. And both of these understandings, the understandings that anger arises because of conditions, and the understanding that actions have consequences, both of these understandings bring the heart to a place that's bigger than our personal situation, to a connectedness and a care that doesn't shrink away or strike out. And this is an aspect of metta that really that offers a mature and balanced understanding of other people and of the world, that takes it all as it is, knowing about the worldly winds, without expecting the world or expecting other people to be other than what they are right now. This is a form of equanimity that comes with the metta practice and with that inclination to compassion. Not as a Brahma-vihara state or the strong kind of equanimity that comes from insight practice, but rather as a simple and practical balance about other people and about how they can be, a mature attitude about the world that doesn't dwell in those assumptions, that doesn't cry, but it's not fair, that understands that people do all sorts of things, wholesome and unwholesome, and understands that the consequences of unwholesome action, of any intentional action, wholesome or unwholesome, actually, are always fair. Maybe not immediately, but inevitably. This understanding is essential because I don't have to tell anyone here how messy the world is right now. Unfortunately, there's no shortage of those people that Sayadaw was talking about yesterday, those Asapurisa Pugla. Just plain bad people are everywhere. And they're making all sorts of trouble. Given conditions, we human beings are pretty good at hating each other, at acting as though those consequences don't exist. And when all that badness monopolizes the global attention, as it tends to do in the wider world, it helps, actually, to remember here and now, on the ground, good people vastly outnumber bad people. And the kind, inspiring things that people do are more common than we may think. And all of you are part of that, that flow of goodness that is metta. And in the context of this difficult category, that flow of metta allows us to wish those difficult people, those bad quote-unquote people, well, very simply. In the interviews in the last days, we've heard a number of people speak about their surprise at how it is actually possible not only to turn the mind to the hardest person on the planet for them, but to actually powerfully radiate metta to them. One person told me the other day that before, in other words, about 10 days ago, they could never imagine being able to do this. But we can. And in this context, I want to use a metaphor of operating systems, you know, like computers, Windows, Linux, whatever. The heart has operating systems. The metta operating system, the fear operating system, the hatred operating system. And I like this metaphor and I use it because when either metta or fear slash hatred are the baseline habits from which we act, speak, and think, they really affect the entire flow of our lives, don't they? Especially when we're faced with the challenge of those worldly winds. So, when we wake up in the morning, when we turn on, quote unquote, what's the first thing that happens? What operating system is coming up? And whatever is most habitually cultivated is what is our baseline operating system. So, for example, if people get old, when people get old, if they have dementia, like Alzheimer's disease or simply senile dementia, they end up losing their superficial identity, their superficial personality traits. Memories and identities and the ability to edit what comes out of the mouth. And what emerges is our deepest habit patterns, our deepest, most established operating systems. And it's sometimes shocking what you can see. Both parents of a very close friend of mine had senile dementia. One just got sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. He had a sweetness operating system very clearly. He had no idea who he was or who we were, but he was sweet. The other parent just became mean. And she had been superficially very polite. It was very interesting to see this. She became openly mean to almost everybody. Really sharp. Nasty. That was her operating system. The Buddha said in the Majjhima Nikaya, whatever a person repeatedly thinks or ponders upon, that becomes the inclination of their mind. If one repeatedly pursues thinking imbued with metta, abandoning thinking imbued with ill will, their mind is bent by that thinking imbued with non-ill will. So if one keeps pursuing thinking imbued with harmlessness, one's mind is bent by that thinking. This articulates so simply what happens here on retreat when we continually create that habit of metta, so that it becomes our operating system, rather than just something we find every once in a while on retreat, when we're quiet and concentrated. And when that habit of metta is established, when there is that metta operating system, then there's calm, peace, stability. And all of you have directly experienced this to some extent or another. So the good news is this kind of calm stability is definitely accessible to us all if we take the time to cultivate it now. And the more we cultivate it, that ongoing cultivation creates the causes and conditions for a calm and stable mind later, for that metta operating system to be the deepest one. Another sutta in the Majjhima Or in another sutta from the Majjhima, the Buddha says how powerful that is in producing a future where there is no longer any possibility for unskillful reactivity to arise. He says, just as a vigorous trumpeter could make himself heard without difficulty in the four quarters, so too, when liberation of mind by loving kindness is developed, no limiting kamma remains there. None persists there. In other words, when those four or eight worldly winds blow, in those four categories of things that change from one to the other, the mind inclines first to metta, rather than to fear, rather than to hatred, or anything else. I was really touched yesterday. Somebody said, why did no one teach me this when I was 3 years old? Life would have been completely different. Yeah. That person was speaking for all of us. But now you all know about the power of metta. And you know how to cultivate it so that it becomes that habitual operating system. And you know you have a choice. You might not be able to access it right now, moment to moment. But once we know how to access it once, that's the potential of this mind and heart. So not to give up if things get bumpy. Not to say, oh, well, I managed that once, but it'll never happen again. It will. And as I've already mentioned in previous talks, when we have this habit of metta, this metta operating system, it's an internal and external protection. Without it, we're tossed here and there, helpless to do anything about the reactivity that's going through the heart, going through the mind. In the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha describes so vividly and perfectly, I think, how very practically fear and hatred and reactivity produce an unstable place to live from. He says, from lust and hatred are born discontent, delight, and hair-raising terror. Having originated from this, the mind's thoughts toss one about as boys toss up a crow. So you can imagine these kids playing with this crow that they've disabled, and they're tossing it up in the air, and this poor bird's, you know, helpless. So without the protection of metta, our mind is tossed here and there, helpless by our reactivity. But metta offers protection from that. And metta is a force of love that's universally protective, everywhere, both of ourselves and others. There's a line that's repeated often in the texts. The Dhamma protects those who protect the Dhamma. And in this context, protecting the Dhamma means practicing, taking care of the mind, developing the mind, cultivating it. So it means practicing metta, cultivating metta, and living it seamlessly. Aria spoke of this seamlessness the other day when she was talking about metta indeed, speech and thought. And truly, all our actions, all our thoughts, all our speech become a big field of practice when we approach them in this way, and a big field of protection. Which brings me to that inevitable question that many of you are asking yourselves, maybe right now. How do I integrate this practice and what I've understood here into my life out there? How do I take this practice out into a world which is calling for action? It's admittedly a challenge to take what you've learned here in these kind of very refined and simple conditions in retreat and to apply them in the greater realm of the life and the outer world. Sometimes it feels like letting medical students out into the hospital. It's like, okay, out you go. But it helps to remember that in here and out there are somewhat artificial distinctions. Yes, things are faster and more complicated, quote unquote, out there, than they are here in the retreat. But there are still just relationships, still just those worldly winds. And we still cultivate metta in thought and also in speech and in action. It's those last two that are more complicated. So the short answer is just to keep doing it. Because the more you do it, the more you can do it. That's what the Buddha meant when he said, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that becomes the inclination of their mind. Keep inclining that way. Keep inclining to that radical kindness that accepts the way you are in this moment without resistance and feeds the metta anyway, that accepts the way other people are in this moment and feeds the metta anyway. This teaching applies everywhere. But, of course, how? How do we do that? Just as a retreat here has a container, things that support the practice, the retreat you begin, those of you who are leaving tomorrow, the retreat you begin tomorrow also has a container and things that support it. And as a container for daily life practice, first thing is ethical conduct. So we first take the five lay precepts and actually hold them. Take them up as a practice, which they're meant to be. They're not rules, they're a practice. They're a development of heart. So sincerely taking them up, rather than just chanting them on occasion. And really, this is easier said than done. So they're very simple, of course. You all, most of you, I think, know them. To refrain from killing living beings. To refrain from stealing. To refrain from any sexual activity that could be harmful. To refrain from lying. And to refrain from intoxicants that cloud the mind. Not just because you should or because it's a good, you know, good people do this, so I ought to, but because it's profoundly protective and a source of ease and happiness. And each of these precepts has an overt way of being held and a subtle one. And often people slide out of one or another. And particularly that last precept, not taking intoxicants that cloud the mind. Well, what's wrong with a glass of wine? What's wrong with it is that it leads us to do things we might regret. It leads us to forgetting, developing the heart, developing the mind. So to actually hold these precepts and take them as a precious container for metta practice in daily life. They involve metta in speech, this practice of not lying, not exaggerating, not harming other people with our speech. As Ariya said yesterday, speech that is true, truthful, useful, spoken at the right time, spoken with a metta heart. This is right speech. Taking that up as a practice. And then metta in action, all those other things. Not intentionally killing, not taking what somebody hasn't overtly offered us, not assuming that we can take it, but asking first. Being careful with our sexuality. And not clouding our mind unnecessarily with substances that might be fun, but they don't go anywhere useful. And then the metta practice itself, when held within this container, can look like almost anything and still be onward leading. Most of you are quite experienced in the practice, so I won't belabor you with the nuts and bolts of integration and how to practice at home. You already know how to do that quite well. But I will recommend that you get creative about it. Because, of course, it's good to practice, to do some formal practice every day, if it's possible, if you have the time. But even if you don't, momentary practice adds up. It's like putting coins in a little piggy bank. And eventually it's full and you count all those coins and you find, wow, that's, you know, 200 euros. A minute is 60 seconds. There's 60 minutes in an hour. So 60 seconds, 60 times a day is an hour of practice. That's not an insignificant amount. And to have those 60 seconds, to add them up through the day, 60 times, there's so many possible ways to do that, and possible places to do that. So if you think about your situation at home, when you get up in the morning, get ready to go to work, however you get there, on foot, on bicycle, in a car, in a train, you're at work, or maybe you have errands to run, you go to a bank or a supermarket. All of this involves things that give us little moments, little slivers of time. Waiting at a traffic light, standing in a queue, walking down the street, riding a bicycle. Anything that involves waiting is particularly fruitful of practice. And this is a space in our day when we tend to fill with our phones, our devices. We distract ourselves. But this is a place where you can practice. You can radiate metta. standing at the street corner waiting for the light to change so you can cross the street. Usually there are a whole bunch of other people standing there. May we all be well, happy, and peaceful. Or standing in a queue at the grocery store. Often this is a place where we get impatient because we want to go home and get our, you know, cooking on the way, you know, and feed our families, feed ourselves. We want to go home and relax. And here we are standing behind all those people. But can we radiate metta instead of going, well, I wish that lady didn't have so many things and now she's gone to take one back and oh, I'm getting all irritated. But may all of us be well, happy, and peaceful. Or maybe on your day off you like to go for a long bike ride or go for a long walk. Well, happy, peaceful, well, happy, peaceful, well, happy, peaceful. As you walk or ride your bike. This kind of activity day to day to day can really set this metta operating system in place so that it really becomes a seamless, effortless background. And it might just be the phrases, but that's actually enough when we're aware that those phrases are going through the mind to incline us to the metta. I like to walk long distances once a year. This year I won't be able to do that, but often every year I try to walk. Last year I walked about 650 kilometers in about a month. Getting out of bed in the morning at some hostel, putting my backpack on, walking out the door into the sun or the rain, whatever it happens to be, and putting one foot in front of the other. Well, happy, peaceful, well, happy, peaceful. Sometimes I forget until I've been going about a kilometer, and then I remember, it's like, oh, that's what I'm here to do. Oh yeah, well, happy, peaceful. It's such a habit now. I had no idea how deeply that groove has been worn into the mind, or how deeply that groove would wear into the mind in a relatively short period of time. So now when I walk to the dining room, just by habit, well, happy, peaceful, often I'm not really inclining to the meaning of those words. It's just kind of empty words. But they're not empty. Because all I have to do is realize it, oh, well, happy, peaceful, what does that mean? Ah, yeah. The cats, the birds, other people. Ah, well, happy people. And it just more deeply habituates this metta habit. This is what gives us that metta operating system. And with that as a basis, the practice becomes seamless eventually, which is essential, that seamlessness. Because, as I said at the outset, the world is full of scary stuff. Especially right now, people are using words like unprecedented and extreme and, you know, apocalyptic to describe what's going on in this world. And the metta is essential in facing that. It always has been, actually. We think, oh, this world is worse than anything else that's ever been seen before, but that's not really true. As extreme and different as it seems, the troubles of the world won't go away with the demise of the current bad guys. This comes back to those unknown assumptions that we can hold about the world. But really, the way the world is, it's our samsaric predicament that there's an endless supply of bad guys. Being prone to hatred, being prone to killing each other over territory, power, or whatever, religion. If it's not one thing or one person, it's something else. And it's been this way since time immemorial. So the thing to remember is that samsara is not supposed to work. This conditioned reality is broken. That's its nature. So when things go wrong, when we're challenged, to have this metta operating system is essential. Because all sorts of things can be difficult. Between and among neighbors, partners, workmates, people. So we just have to remember to take a deep breath and cultivate that metta habit wherever we find ourselves. Know what's coming up in relationship to others. Feed it if it's wholesome, but don't feed it if it's unwholesome. Take responsibility if there are reactions, rather than blaming outer conditions for causing us suffering. And inclining the mind, always, and heart to metta and compassion, because this is the root of effective response, not those reactions. It's then also the nature of the world not just to be broken, but to be a place where we can't always do anything about that brokenness. But sometimes you can do something. And in that case, a metta response is always, always, always more effective than a response rooted in that knee-jerk anger or fear. So with speech, when we respond with metta-based speech, it's true, it's useful. It's spoken at the right time, with a sensitivity. Even if we have something really difficult to convey to somebody, that other person will be more open to hearing it than if we just come at them with, some really angry response. Of course, that just makes people turn off. So skillful speech can be transformative in difficult situations. And with regard to action, metta action is much more likely to offer us the result that we desire. Because metta action won't create a knee-jerk response in somebody else. So before speaking and before acting, if it's possible to reflect about what we're going to say and what we're going to do, in a way that brings that balance of equanimity. This is what always offers more space for the metta to naturally arise. So in terms of speech, what is it possible to say? And what is it useful? What is reasonable? And what is not reasonable? Just knowing these, taking a moment to go, oh, well, that's not going to go anywhere. That can be very, very helpful. And then with speech and action as practice, also reflecting about how do you deal with being unsuccessful? Because sometimes we do our best and we fail completely. Sometimes the bad guys win. Life is like that. But getting discouraged is self-indulgent. It's a luxury that we don't have in this world. Just because hatred and violence seem to have won the day, that's absolutely not the reason to become fatalistic or to give up. I really am deeply, deeply inspired by His Holiness the Dalai Lama in this regard, because when I reflect about what he's faced in his life of challenge, of disappointment, of failure, and when I reflect about the radiance of his heart, of his speech, of his action, I realize this is possible. If he can do it, maybe I can try. And he says, compassion is the radicalism of our time. The more you are motivated by love, the more fearless and free your action will be. If you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. He's also very funny. So sometimes the world calls us to do something, anything. What we do and what we say matter. And letting these be metta speech and metta actions. And no thing is too small. I really love December and January here in Burma when we metta in action friends gather together. November, December, January. We pool all the money each of us has collected from generous donors all over the world. And we change it into Myanmar chat, and we put it in my trunk in the monastery in Yangon, and we look at it and go, boy, now we're going to give it away. And we started this as a spontaneous response of metta to the huge challenges faced by people in this country during the cyclone that came in 2008. And, you know, there were only two of us doing this at the time. Maria brought money in from Australia. She'd been teaching there, and many donors offered. Donna and I had a little of my own money here, not much. And we went around the neighborhood giving rice and oil to people living around the monastery, supporting some nuns, not very many. And it made us feel less helpless in the face of terrible circumstances, in the face of those four worldly winds. We weren't planning to do anything, but then the next year people were saying, oh, are you still collecting money? And the next year, and the next year, and the next year, and the next year. 12 years later, we're still doing it. And we see now the accumulated goodness of that. Where nuns who had been living in little crummy bamboo shacks are now living in two-story concrete buildings. Where Sayadaw's village has a water system where people don't have to collect water from the river anymore. It has a health clinic. Soon it'll have a hospital. Where there four, literally, or five schools that weren't there before, educating hundreds of children and supporting the families of all the teachers and supporting all the nuns. It's just one drop at a time. Metta action has consequences, and it adds up. And this is what purifies, just as metta purifies the mind internally, Metta can purify the world externally around us. Somebody gave me a book this summer that I just love. It's a book that I reread from time to time, little pieces of it, because it's heartwarming, it's entertaining, it causes me to chuckle to myself and to cry, actually, from time to time. It's a book called Barking to the Choir, which is kind of a mixed mashup of two English idioms, by a fellow named Gregory Boyle. He's a Catholic priest in East Los Angeles. In 1988, he was sent to this parish, to a mission church, to be the pastor, and an area that was rife with gang warfare. And he wanted to do something to help. And he started a company called Homeboy Industries, where he would hire these guys out of prison or off the streets. And now this has morphed over the years into something that's quite huge. Hundreds of companies, you know, in many, many, many people's lives have been changed. He's a man who deeply knows both love and hate, who is deeply familiar with violence. And the challenge of this daily task of accessing love, accessing that metta operating system in a difficult world. He says this, "I have never seen anything so able to diffuse a burst of violence or the spewing of hate, or the indifference of those in pain, than love, shown in a kind word, gesture, stance, and presence. Love is the answer. Community is the context. And tenderness is the methodology." Love is the answer. Community is the context. And tenderness is the methodology. I love that. So you've all done a ton of practice in these last days, whether you're staying or whether you're going. And it shows. You may not think so, but it shows. So to those of you who are leaving, please go out and radiate. Be the light in your community, for your family, in your workplace. Let that metta operating system you have developed here shine out with tenderness. May it become your deepest habit in your thoughts, in your actions, and in your speech, with your friends and with your enemies, all the days of your lives. Heartfelt thanks, everybody, for your beautiful practice. And thank you for your kind attention.